Chapter 8, The Need for Effective and Efficient Anti-Corruption Machinery of State. The acronym STIRS, S-T-I-R-S, is a handy way of describing the main attributes of anti-corruption entities that are able to counter corruption effectively and efficiently. These criteria are required to achieve compliance with the international obligations under the United Nations Convention Against Corruption and other treaties. Applying the criteria accords with respect for human rights of those governed. In short, specialized denotes an entity that is dedicated to dealing with corruption and corruption only. The corrupt are a wily lot who are forever seeking new ways of relieving the unwary of assets and funds. It is a full-time job to keep up with and counter the innovative thinking of the corrupt, hence the need for specialization. Some call this feature an entity dedicated to anti-corruption work, to the exclusion of all other types of crime busting. Trained refers to the state of readiness and expertise of corruption busters to do their work properly. Independent is the requirement that the entity be above political influence and interference from the powerful, whether in government or in corrupt networks, so that it can function without fear, favor, or prejudice. Resources that are sufficient, and the provision of which is guaranteed to enable the entity to do its work. Security of tenure of office is required so that unpopular decisions made do not turn out to be career-threatening or limiting. Researchers employed by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development have for many years worked on a variety of criteria that should be expected in anti-corruption machinery of state. The output of their research, as it stood in 2010, was placed before the South African Apex Court, its constitutional court, in the course of argument in a matter in which judgment was handed down on the 17th of March 2011. The justices considered the various criteria in the OECD research and picked on the STIRS criteria as those identifying anti-corruption machinery of state that is effective and efficient at countering the corrupt. The result of this selection process is that while all of the criteria set out in the OECD research are informative and instructive, five criteria have the force of binding law in South Africa. These criteria are accordingly available for use in argument elsewhere in the world as persuasive authority emanating from the highest court in South Africa. The cogency of the court's choice is so compelling that the STIRS criteria ought to serve as a useful starting point in any serious consideration, anywhere, of what it is that identifies the best of anti-corruption machinery of state. It is on this basis that the analysis that follows is offered as a guide to those involved in the important work of countering the corrupt. Speaking in Cape Town, on the occasion of his election as President of the Conference of Constitutional Jurisdictions of Africa, on the 26th of April 2017, the Chief Justice of South Africa, Mogoeng Mogoeng, pointed out that corruption is a key element hampering the alleviation of poverty in Africa. He told delegates at the conference that we enjoy the singular honor as judges of courts on this continent of eradicating corruption. But we can only do that if we are not corrupt. It takes the uncorrupted to deal effectively with those who are corrupt. Pointing to the need to develop an African best practice for upholding constitutions so that Africa could one day become the stronghold of the rule of law around the world, he said, "If only we can be united in the vision that has long been waited for, the vision of demonstrating to all that African people have what it takes to take their continent to the greatest heights that it was once known for." The centrality of the success of countering the corrupt in the constitutional projects around Africa is succinctly expressed by the Chief Justice. The corrosive effects of corruption are seen by him as an ever-present threat to people-centered progress and shared prosperity in Africa. The Constitutional Court in South Africa has been at the forefront of developing the jurisprudence necessary to achieve the eventual eradication of corruption. It has sat through a trilogy of cases initiated by a Gauteng businessman, Hugh Bob Glenister, who has steadfastly endeavoured, through the use of lawfare, to secure efficient, effective, and adequately independent machinery of state to combat the corrupt. The Glenister cases have spawned imaginative judicial interventions based on the notion that failure to take appropriate measures to combat corruption is regarded as a violation of human rights in South Africa. This notion has been developed by the Constitutional Court because it regards the justiciable obligations of the state under the Bill of Rights, which is Chapter 2 of the Constitution, as matters affected by corruption. Delivery of many of these rights, in particular the socio-economic rights, is an expensive exercise in the provision of basic education, access to housing, health care, and social security, among other things. It accordingly behoves the state to establish the necessary machinery to deal decisively with corrupt activities wherever they manifest themselves. By so doing, the state is enabled to ensure that public funds are spent for the public good and are not frittered away by the corrupt. The manner in which the Constitutional Court views the concept of corruption has been encapsulated in the words of the majority, Deputy Chief Justice Moseneke and Justice Cameron, in the seminal decision of the 17th of March 2011 in the second Glenister case. There they say, "There can be no gainsaying that corruption threatens to fell at the knees virtually everything we hold dear and precious in our hard-won constitutional order. It blatantly undermines the democratic ethos, the institutions of democracy, the rule of law, and the foundational values of our nascent constitutional project. It fuels maladministration and public fraudulence and imperils the capacity of the state to fulfill its obligations to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill all the rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights. When corruption and organized crime flourish, sustainable development and economic growth are stunted, and in turn, the stability and security of society is put at risk." This far-reaching dictum eloquently identifies the nature of the problem posed to society by corruption's corrosive effects. In Glenister 3, heard together with a less ambitious matter brought by the Helen Suzman Foundation, the poetic words quoted above were fortified by a larger majority of the court in the opening words of the judgment penned by the South African Chief Justice. "All South Africans across the racial, religious, class, and political divide are in broad agreement that corruption is rife in this country and that stringent measures are required to contain this malady before it graduates into something terminal. We are in one accord that South Africa needs an agency dedicated to the containment and eventual eradication of the scourge of corruption. We also agree that that entity must enjoy adequate structural and operational independence to deliver effectively and efficiently on its core mandate. And this, in a way, is the issue that lies at the heart of this matter. Does the South African Police Service Act, as amended again, comply with the constitutional obligation to establish an adequately independent anti-corruption agency?" The Constitutional Court in South Africa has also, in interpreting the concept of corruption as a malady with potential terminal effects, had regard to the international obligations assumed by the government of South Africa insofar as combating corruption is concerned. The majority in the second Glenister case found that the international law obligations undertaken by South Africa at UN, AU, and even SADC level bound the state to have an anti-corruption entity that is effective and adequately independent to honour the international obligations so undertaken. Let us examine the limits and scope of the implementation of these jurisprudential gifts to good governance in Africa, and indeed worldwide in constitutional democracies, bestowed by the judgments in the Glenister cases. It is inescapable that even the best substantive laws against corruption are only as good as the manner in which they are implemented. Dysfunction in the South African Criminal Justice Administration, acknowledged by then Deputy Minister of Justice Advocate Johnny de Lange in the August 2008 parliamentary debate on the dissolution of the Directorate of Special Operations, or Scorpions as they were popularly known, continues to dog the enforcement of the common and statutory laws against corruption. Capture of the leadership of the South African Police Service and the National Prosecuting Authority by feral members of the political elite during and even before the Zuma administrations had exacerbated the malady. Efficient and effective machinery of state that is able, using a high standard of ethics, to deal accountably with the scourge of corruption is required by Section 195 of the Constitution of South Africa. The actual work of preventing and combating corruption is currently that of the Directorate of Priority Crime Investigation, or Hawks Unit, of the South African Police Service, which works in conjunction with the National Prosecuting Authority. The National Prosecuting Authority has no legislated investigative capacity in respect of corruption since the demise of the Scorpions. It prosecutes the cases brought to it by the Hawks. The constitutionality of locating within the National Prosecuting Authority an investigative directorate to look into state capture is questionable, as the proclamation by the President contradicts the will of the legislature in the laws that disbanded the Scorpions and created the Hawks. An informal anti-corruption task team exists but does not really function as a team or with any degree of cohesion, effectiveness, and efficiency. The very notion of an anti-corruption task team contradicts the court-prescribed requirement of a single entity to combat corruption. In this regard, the wording used in the passage quoted above from Glenister 3 is instructive. The three fundamental structural and operational requirements are an agency which is dedicated and specializes in combating corruption. The Hawks Unit is not dedicated to combating corruption. Its mandate extends to all forms of priority crimes. The multi-agency approach to the thorny task of combating corruption has not found favour in the jurisprudence of the courts. By persisting with its dysfunctional anti-corruption task team, the executive continues an approach that is not sanctioned by the courts. The apex court has so ruled in a manner which is binding on the state. In reaching its important conclusions on combating corruption, the majority in Glenister 2 examined the criteria according to which the effectiveness and autonomy of anti-corruption entities are characterized in the work of the experts within the OECD who have long studied the issues around combating corruption. The majority, 5 of the 9 justices seized of the matter, found that specialization, training, and independence, resources that are guaranteed, and security of tenure of office are the criteria which are the hallmarks of an effective anti-corruption entity of state. these criteria have in subsequent argument and discussion of the issues in Glenister 2 and later litigation discussed below become known as the STIRS criteria, a useful acronym that has saved a great deal of printer's ink. These criteria have been developed by the court because of its abhorrence of corruption and its willingness to give substance to the obligations of the state to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights guaranteed to all in the Bill of Rights. This may be regarded as an expansive approach to the problems posed by corruption. The approach is justified and is supplemented by the treaty obligations undertaken by the South African government, principally the United Nations Convention Against Corruption, which also obliges signatory states to keep adequately independent anti-corruption machinery of state. The necessity for autonomy in effective anti-corruption machinery is well illustrated by phenomena such as state capture, a silent coup, and the hijacking of state-owned enterprises, all of which are beyond the scope of this chapter. The Constitutional Court is well informed on the issues at hand and the need to regard corruption as a threat to the essence of constitutional democracy as it relates to the ordinary citizen. The better life sought in the Constitution through the enjoyment of human rights guaranteed to all in the Bill of Rights cannot be achieved if corruption is rife or the state is captured. In its effect, state capture is corruption on a grand scale. Those states that do fall captive to feral elites swiftly degenerate into failed states, as happened in Zimbabwe, Somalia, and elsewhere in Africa. In failed states, the poor suffer terrible deprivation, and the pensions of public servants are not paid. The STIRS criteria of the majority in Glenister 2 have to be properly implemented and taken seriously by the executive and legislative branches of government if the descent to destruction is to be avoided. The public administration, especially the Criminal Justice Administration, and specifically the prosecution service, have to be up to the task at hand. If key functionaries, especially those in the Criminal Justice Administration, are corrupt and captured, then the prospects of combating corruption successfully are dealt a death blow. It is plain from the passages in the judgments quoted above that the courts do regard corruption as a serious threat to the constitutional dispensation. The fealty of the courts to the rule of law remains steadfast. While best practice solutions to the failure of the executive to implement the STIRS criteria properly are beyond the scope of this chapter, it is strongly arguable that the establishment of an integrity commission under Chapter 9 of the Constitution in South Africa is the best way in which to convert judicial decision-making on the STIRS criteria into the lived reality in governance. In Glenister 2, the successful applicant was able to persuade the narrowest possible majority of justices in the Constitutional Court that the Hawks, in their original legislated incarnation, were not an adequately independent entity to be an effective corruption-busting unit in the legislative framework and operational regime contemplated by the scheme of legislation passed to give effect to the resolution of the African National Congress taken at Polokwane in December 2007. This was a resolution which called for the urgent dissolution of the Scorpions and their replacement with what became the Hawks. The motivation for the resolution was far from pure. The Scorpions were wont to investigate too many politically well-connected people. The majority of the court found that the human rights commitments of the state undertaken in the Bill of Rights necessitated the creation and maintenance of an adequately independent anti-corruption entity of state to prevent and combat corruption. Majority also found that the international law obligations undertaken by South Africa at United Nations, African Union, and even SADC level, bound the state to have an anti-corruption entity that is effective and adequately independent to honour the international obligations so undertaken. This finding has implications in all jurisdictions in which similar treaty obligations have been undertaken. The majority in Glenister II identified the STIRS criteria as the critical characteristics of adequately independent and effective anti-corruption machinery of state. These criteria are of universal application in constitutional democracies under the rule of law. Comparative research reveals that compliance with them is an indicator of state competence in combating corruption, while the converse also applies. The work of the experts within the structures of the OECD, who have long studied the issues around combating corruption, informed the decision reached on what have become known as the STIRS criteria. Specialization of an institution means that its staff complement has to be dedicated to one function and one function only. In this case, it means dealing with the corrupt decisively as a full-time job, not part of a job that has other features and other functions. A dedicated and single-minded approach is required that is quite the antithesis of a priority crimes unit that deals with diverse crimes deserving priority attention from time to time. The Hawks work on poaching, drug dealing, human trafficking, and a host of other priority crimes that leave corruption languishing at the bottom of the piles in their pending workload. Training of the personnel in the intricacies of anti-corruption work is an obvious essential. The Scorpions, when they were formed, were taken to the Federal Bureau of Investigation and to Scotland Yard for specialized training by the Serious Frauds Office and the corruption specialists in the American FBI. This has not been replicated in the case of the Hawks, who are regarded as a police unit in their structure and operations. Independence, the ability to act without fear of the powerful, favour to the friendly, or prejudice to the public, is the defining characteristic of a truly effective anti-corruption entity. The wherewithal to withstand political interference, nefarious influences, and all attempts to derail investigations is at the core of successful corruption busting. The Hawks are not appropriately equipped or located to operate at the same level of independence from the executive as the Scorpions were able to achieve. This difference is due to the contrasting ethos of a police unit and particularly to the Scorpions' reporting lines in the National Prosecuting Authority, ending in the Office of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, who is an independent functionary, while those in the police end with the Minister and the National Commissioner of Police, neither of whom is independent or even legally required to be politically expected to be so. The Commissioner is the accounting officer of the Hawks. This feature of the structure tends to undermine the independence of the latter. The guaranteeing of resources for the anti-corruption entity is required in order to prevent feral or venal elites from cutting off or limiting funding to the anti-corruption entity by adjusting its resources, infrastructure, personnel complement, and accommodation. Proper resourcing is clearly a sine qua non of success. The Hawks leadership has complained to Parliament that the offices occupied by the Hawks are not fit for human habitation. Esprit de corps and the necessary will to take on the corrupt are difficult to generate in any under-resourced or demoralized anti-corruption entity. The existence of numerous vacancies within the ranks of the Hawks exacerbates its inefficiency and ineffectiveness while also undermining esprit de corps. Given the history of the dissolution of the Scorpions, the last of the STIRS criteria, security of tenure of office, is particularly important in South Africa. Without security of tenure for all of its key personnel, the anti-corruption entity is vulnerable to attack or even closure. Protection of personnel who take on powerful people who are alleged to be involved in corrupt activities is essential to the survival of any anti-corruption entity worth its salt. Quite the opposite has occurred in the cases of General Anwar Dramot, who was eased into a severance package after he took an interest in obtaining the Nkandla dockets, and General Johan Boysen, the former head of the Hawks in KwaZulu-Natal. The latter has accepted an early retirement package after a long and exhausting battle to retain his position. By fashioning the research of the OECD into the STIRS criteria, the Constitutional Court has developed the jurisprudence concerning the combating of corruption in a remarkable way that holds lessons for the entire world, and in particular in emerging constitutional states in which corruption is a real and present danger to the survival of the state. The Strong Institutions UN Sustainable Development Goal is dependent upon STIRS compliance in all countries that aspire to the achievement of the SDGs. The operative orders in the Glenister 2 appeal to the Constitutional Court were that the Hawks legislation was not constitutionally compliant, in that the Hawks were not an effective and adequately independent anti-corruption entity as required by the international obligations of the country and its constitutional commitment to upholding human rights by respecting, protecting, promoting, and fulfilling the rights guaranteed to all in the Bill of Rights. Parliament was given 18 months to take appropriate remedial action to address the unconstitutional aspects of the structural and operational features of the Hawks. The court was not prescriptive about the steps required, showing due deference to the other branches of government, and with proper regard to the doctrine of the separation of powers, the court asked only that Parliament make the decision of a reasonable decision maker in the circumstances. Some of the relevant circumstances are encapsulated in the STIRS criteria. Others have to do with the state of play in society at any given time. A calm and quiet society in which the incidence of corruption is rare obviously requires different anti-corruption machinery of state to one in which corruption is a national pastime of crippling proportions. Sledgehammers are not used for killing fleas, but, on the other hand, knives ought not to be taken to a gunfight. It is clear to all involved in the process of preparing remedial legislation to give effect to the ruling in Glenister 2 that the political will to rethink attitudes towards fighting the corrupt properly with appropriate machinery of state is lacking. Instead, as little as possible was done to make the Hawks constitutionally compliant in a process that involved the tweaking of the legislation relating to the Hawks as minimally as possible. They remain in the police. Their accounting officer is still the National Commissioner of Police, and the opportunities for executive influence and interference patent in the structure of the bill are left unaddressed. Objections to its constitutionality fell on deaf ears in Parliament, the Presidency, at the Human Rights Commission, and at the Office of the Public Protector. The supposedly remedial bill was an attempt to do as little as possible to the existing structure and functioning of the Hawks while paying lip service to compliance with the binding effect of the judgment of the Constitutional Court in Glenister 2 and to its introduction of the STIRS criteria into the law of the land. Despite energetic tweaking during the parliamentary process, the Remedial Act retained many features that were not STIRS compliant. This inadequate response by government was not acceptable to the Helen Suzman Foundation and to Glenister himself. Both moved to impugn the constitutionality of the amending legislation immediately it was made law. Glenister objected to the location of the Hawks within the police in the circumstances in which the Hawks, the police and the executive branch of government found themselves at the time of the passage of the legislation through the lawmaking process. He adduced expert evidence which expressed the opinion that corruption is endemic in the executive, the police and the Hawks. The Helen Suzman Foundation took a narrower and more technical approach by not assailing the location of the Hawks in the police, but by comparing the provisions of the new legislative dispensation for them with the STIRS requirements laid down in Glenister 2, points which were also made by Glenister. Working separately, both the Helen Suzman Foundation and Glenister initially made applications for direct access to the Constitutional Court. Their approaches were rebuffed without a hearing on the basis that it was not in the interest of justice to give direct access. Still working separately, they then applied to the Western Cape High Court for urgent relief aimed at challenging the constitutionality of the new legislation and at making the anti-corruption machinery of state constitutionally compliant. Their matters were heard together on the semi-urgent roll by three judges. The Helen Suzman Foundation met with limited success in that court, while Glenister's case was dismissed, and his efforts to introduce evidence of the relevant circumstances militating against keeping the Hawks within the police were struck out with punitive costs awards against him. The court regarded the opinion evidence pertaining to those circumstances as vexatious and irrelevant. None of the parties were satisfied with the judgment and all appealed to the Constitutional Court. The Helen Suzman Foundation also sought confirmation of the invalidity orders it had won. Government persisted in defending the constitutionality of the new legislation, contending that it was compliant with the Constitution and with the STIRS requirements laid down in binding fashion in Glenister 2. It is necessary to look at the language employed in the majority judgment in Glenister 2 to determine whether the amending legislation, which was impugned for its lack of constitutionality in Glenister 3, met the required STIRS standards. There are three passages in the majority judgment which require careful examination. Firstly, the creation of a separate corruption-fighting unit within the South African Police Service was not in itself unconstitutional, and thus the Hawks legislation cannot be invalidated on that ground alone. The phrases "in itself" and "on that ground alone" should be read to have meaning. The Constitutional Court does not drop meaningless phrases into serious judgments it hands down on topics as fraught as the highly contested adequacy of the Hawks as an appropriate anti-corruption entity. These phrases suggest, so it was argued by Glenister, that in the current circumstances in which corruption has infested both the criminal justice system and the executive branch of government, the police is not a legally appropriate institution in which to house the anti-corruption machinery of state. Somewhat presciently, the argument was that if the police and the Hawks are working for a federal elite, then the STIRS criteria, especially independence, cannot be met. Subsequent allegations of state capture and the suborning of police leadership would appear to bear out the argument raised without success by Glenister. Secondly, the court said, now plainly there are many ways in which the state can fulfil its duty to take positive measures to respect, protect, promote and fulfil the rights in the Bill of Rights. This court will not be prescriptive as to what measures the state takes as long as they fall within the range of possible conduct that a reasonable decision maker in the circumstances may adopt. A range of possible measures is therefore open to the state, all of which will accord with the duty the Constitution imposes, so long as the measures taken are reasonable. Glenister regarded the words "in the circumstances" and "so long as the measures taken are reasonable" as pregnant with meaning. He argued that Justice O'Regan had illustrated the position definitively in her judgment in the matter of Rail Commuters Action Group when she wrote for a unanimous court, "What constitutes reasonable measures will depend on the circumstances of each case. Factors that would ordinarily be relevant would include the nature of the duty, the social and economic context in which it arises, the range of factors that are relevant to the performance of the duty, the extent to which the duty is closely related to the core activities of the duty bearer, the closer they are, the greater the obligation on the duty bearer, and the extent of any threat to fundamental rights should the duty not be met, as well as the intensity of any harm that may result." This important dictum of a unanimous court was not properly taken into account and applied as it should have been in the judgment in Glenister 3. In Glenister 2, it was footnoted with approval. Thirdly, this court has indicated that the appearance or perception of independence plays an important role in evaluating whether independence in fact exists. This was said in connection with the appointment procedures and security of tenure of magistrates. By applying this criterion, we do not mean to impose on Parliament the obligation to create an agency with a measure of independence appropriate to the judiciary. We say merely that public confidence in mechanisms that are designed to secure independence is indispensable. Whether a reasonably informed and reasonable member of the public will have confidence in an entity's autonomy-protecting features is important to determine whether it has the requisite degree of independence. Hence, if Parliament fails to create an institution that appears from the reasonable standpoint of the public to be independent, it has failed to meet one of the objective benchmarks for its independence. This is because public confidence that an institution is independent is a component of, or is constitutive of, its independence. Glenister argued that the Constitutional Court in this passage had made it clear that public belief in the independence of the corruption-fighting entity was a prerequisite for a finding that the entity was in fact independent. Measured against the STIRS requirements spelt out by the Constitutional Court for a properly independent anti-corruption authority, Glenister was concerned that the amending legislation had not solved significant problems in the establishment of the Hawks, and set out to address these issues in his founding papers filed of record in Glenister 3. He laid particular emphasis on the question of public perception of the independence of the Hawks. In pursuit of his argument that the entire scheme of the amending legislation failed the appropriate test of independence, Glenister set out to illustrate that the scheme did not fall within the range of possible conduct that a reasonable decision maker could adopt in the circumstances, and that accordingly, Parliament had not adopted reasonable measures to respect, protect, promote, and fulfil the rights in the Bill of Rights. He did so by reference to a host of incidents and events that evidenced corruption, and by reference to expert testimony premised upon evidence of corruption and public perception thereof. The respondents who opposed the application had chosen not to respond to this evidence, but requested the High Court to strike it out. The High Court had done so with the punitive costs award, and the striking out order formed part of the subject matter in Glenister's application for leave to appeal. Early in the Constitutional Court hearing of argument in Helen Suzman Foundation, Glenister 3, there were indications in questioning from the bench that At least an element of the bench saw the judgment in Glenister 2 quite differently from the way in which Glenister had interpreted it. The difference in interpretation of what the express terms of the judgment meant is starkly illustrated in a comparison of the judgment of the majority in Glenister 3, penned by Chief Justice Mogoeng, and a minority judgment written by Justice Froneman. Extracts from the majority judgment that portray its interpretation of Glenister 2 are enlightening. Chief Justice said, "The allegations in the struck-out material amount to reckless and odious political posturing or generalizations which should find no accommodation or space in a proper court process. The objective appears to be to scandalize and to use the court to spread political propaganda that projects others as irredeemable crooks who will inevitably actualize Mr. Clem Sunter's alleged projection that South Africa may well become a failed state. This stereotyping and political narrative are an abuse of court process. A determination of the validity of the Hawke's legislation does not require a resort to this loose talk. These assertions or conclusions are scandalous, vexatious, or irrelevant. Courts should not lightly allow vitriolic statements of this kind to form part of the record of evidence, and courts should never be seen to be condoning this kind of inappropriate behaviour embarked upon under the guise of robustness." In dealing with Glenister's well-reasoned attack on the location of the Hawks within the police service as being incompatible with the independence requirement laid down in Glenister 2, the judgment is equally strident. Mr. Glenister seeks to rely on evidence of public perception of corruption sourced from the TNS statement of 22nd October 2012. At that time, the public perception of corruption existed for a period of over 6 years, although there had since been a marginal improvement. Reliance is also placed on the ISS monograph, which was published 5 months after the delivery of Glenister 2, and could not therefore have been based on public perception that only came into being after Glenister 2. That means that when Glenister 2 was decided in 2011, the high levels of corruption Mr. Glenister now seeks to inform the court about were already an established fact. The inescapable consequence of the age of these high levels of corruption in the private and public sectors, including the police, is that this court failed to have due regard to the public perception of corruption in the police at the time we decided Glenister 2. Its decision that the mere location of the Hawks within the police cannot invalidate the Hawks legislation was in effect wrong. Glenister 2's decision on location is, on this logic, not one that a reasonable decision maker in the circumstances may adopt. Mr. Glenister can therefore only be understood to be suggesting that the decision about the location of the Hawks in Glenister 2 was wrong. The majority upheld the striking out of the evidence sought to be adduced by Glenister, and with it the basis for his attack on the location of the Hawks within the police service. A new ground for striking out was created: odious political posturing. It accordingly dismissed his application for leave to appeal against the order dismissing his main application to have the amending legislation declared unconstitutional, and the striking out of the evidence he sought to adduce. Justice Froneman, on the other hand, in his minority judgment in Glenister 3, adopted a more nuanced approach to the case sought to be presented on behalf of Glenister. Justice Froneman said, "The main judgment finds that Glenister 2 foreclosed both the constitutional challenge that Mr. Glenister sought to bring against the Police Amendment Act, as well as the evidence that he sought to adduce to sustain that challenge. I disagree. Glenister 2 does neither. That decision needs to be revisited. It must be done appropriately, with reasoned discussion and justification for any change, should not be done by a reinterpretation of its meaning that narrows its original scope without explaining the necessity for the change. With reference to the manner in which Glenister too had dealt with the constitutional obligation to establish an anti-corruption authority, Justice Froneman recorded the following. The judgment does not state that the creation of a separate corruption fighting unit within the police will withstand any constitutional attack. It says that something else will be needed in order to sustain that kind of constitutional challenge. Mr. Glenister sought to show that the additional factor was that the current extent of corruption in our body politic was of the kind that showed that the location of the hawks within the police was not a possible option for a reasonable decision maker. In other words, he contended that this evidence showed that locating the hawks within the police meant that it could not have sufficient attributes of independence to fulfill the functions required of it under the Bill of Rights. His attempt to do so fell squarely within the range of approaches left open by Glenister too. Justice Froneman summed up his assessment of the dicta in Glenister II as they applied to the case presented in Glenister III as follows. To sum up, Glenister II did not hold that there could be no challenge to the location of the hawks within the police, only that the mere fact of its location within the police was not sufficient to sustain a constitutional challenge. Nor did it lay down that no evidence may be adduced in support of a constitutional challenge that was based on something more than the fact of the hawk's location within the police. Glenister too does not preclude the presentation of evidence of the context within which the range of possible options open to a reasonable decision maker should be assessed. Nor does it prohibit evidence about the public perception of corruption within that context. Mr. Glenister sought to introduce additional evidence of corruption in our body politic and the public perception of the extent of that corruption in order to bolster his constitutional challenge that currently it is not a reasonable option to locate the hawks within the police. Glenister too, I repeat, allows him to do that. The main judgment finds that the evidence of public perception that Mr. Glenister sought to present showed that the perception already existed at the time of Glenister II, and hence this evidence takes the matter no further than what the judgment already decided. I disagree. First, the evidence presented in this matter is not all the same as that which was before the court in Glenister II. Second, the challenge here is predicated on what Glenister II decided. The legal ground for the challenge here was created by Glenister II, and thus the challenge is not precluded by the application of some kind of res judicata principle. It is one thing for this court to find that the case Mr. Glenister presented was not convincing, but quite another to say that he is prevented by our past decision from doing so. If there are aspects of Glenister II which need to be revisited or clarified, it must be done explicitly, not through a reinterpretation that is at odds with what the judgment actually says. It is perplexing that two judicial interpretations of the same judgment of the Constitutional Court made by justices of that court could be so diametrically opposed, particularly when it is considered that the majority judgment in Glenister II was penned by Deputy Chief Justice Moseneke and Justice Cameron, with whom Justice Froneman, among others, concurred, while Deputy Chief Justice Moseneke concurred with the majority judgment in Glenister III, and Justice Cameron concurred with Justice Froneman's minority judgment. Remarkably, but perfectly properly so, The Chief Justice who wrote the majority judgment in Glenister 3 was in the minority in Glenister 2, a minority which had no difficulty with the constitutionality of the original legislation creating the Hawks. Regrettably, for effective combating of corruption and for Glenister, he failed to persuade the majority with his argument that an independent corruption-fighting entity in South Africa had, in the prevailing circumstances, to be situated outside the police service. The manner in which the majority in Glenister 3 has gone about interpreting the passages quoted from Glenister 2 in the preceding section does not stand up to legal or logical scrutiny. It is perhaps informed by a sense of protectiveness towards the executive, an underlying executive-mindedness, or possibly judicial unwillingness, as at November 2014, to face the fact that the body politic in South Africa is indeed seriously corrupt. Subsequent allegations of state capture, the Public Protector's State of Capture report, and the exposure of ever more skullduggery in high places via the so-called Gupta leaks would suggest that the majority may now regret its unwillingness to engage with the hard facts included in the odious political posturing it perceived back then. Had the Nkandla judgment, for example, preceded the hearing of Glenister 3, the expert testimony put up by Mr. Glenister may not have fallen on such barren ground. The approach of the minority, as encapsulated in the passages from the judgment of Justice Froneman quoted above, is preferable because it does not have the effect of possibly painting the court into a corner, as the majority judgment does. Justice von der Westhuizen, who sat only in Glenister 1 and Glenister 3, placed an endnote on his separate dissenting judgment. He said, "Corruption threatens the very existence of our constitutional democracy. Effective laws and institutions to combat corruption are therefore absolutely essential. It is the task of the courts, and this court in particular, to ensure that legal mechanisms against corruption are as trustworthy and tight as possible within the demands and parameters of the Constitution." But courts can only do so much. A corruption-free society can only develop in the hearts and minds of its people, particularly the ones occupying positions of political and economic power. We need dedication to the spirit and high aspirations of the Constitution. Institutions are tools designed to help people realize their ambitions. Much dedication is required on the part of those handling the tools. Of course, the structure of our institutional watchdogs must be made as immune to corruption as possible. But even the most sophisticated institutional design will require the exercise of discretion and therefore integrity on the part of and trust in the office bearer. Thoroughly closing all perceived loopholes will guarantee little. The more procedures and processes we put in place to safeguard against corruption, the more plausible the deniability we give to a corrupt actor if all the technical boxes have been ticked. Generally, abstract institutional designs cannot be corrupt. As we know, people can be. The task of ensuring that legal mechanisms are as tight and trustworthy as possible cannot be achieved if the court closes its eyes to the circumstances as envisaged in Glenister 2 and ignores the perceptions of the public which are regarded as critical in the same judgment. The oversight functions of the legislature and its constitutional duty to hold the executive and Chapter 9 institutions to account should be harnessed in the interests of creating a climate in which the public can indeed trust the effectiveness of the STIRS criteria because they are rigorously in place and not because minimal lip service is paid to them. The current work rate of the Hawks is considerably below that of the Scorpions and even the Hawks themselves in the early years of their existence. The Hawks do not comply properly with a single element of the Sturs criteria laid down by the Constitutional Court in Glenister 2. The attempt in Glenister 3 to render the legislation as amended constitutionally compliant has been a failure, given the matters that have arisen and the developments that have occurred since the judgment was delivered in November 2014. The necessary sapiential authority or clout is simply absent in the leadership and the operations of the Hawks. The Hawks are not specialized. They have not received appropriate training. Their independence is highly questionable. They are not properly resourced. The experiences of Dramot, Sabia, also controversially implicated in the Zimbabwean rendition case, who were hounded out of leadership positions in the Hawks, and Boyson, persecuted into early retirement by false charges that he led a death squad in Durban, show that they do not enjoy security of tenure of office. Even the fate of Dramot's successor, Ntlemeza, and his professional demise are indicative of this weakness in the legislation. The abusive manner in which the Hawks have participated in the persecution of former Minister of Finance Pravin Gordhan and others is deplorably so proof of their lack of independence. In short, the Hawks currently do not comply with any of the criteria laid down in Glenister 2 for their effective structural and operational performance requirements. Hindsight is an exact science. With the benefit of hindsight, the Constitutional Court majority in Glenister 3 and those in the minority who did not consider that the gravity of the situation was a circumstance justifying the removal of the anti-corruption authority from the police ought surely to be concerned that their positions need to be revisited. It is also up to the legislature, as the oversight body which holds the executive accountable, to bring the situation into line with what the law requires, which is a STIRS-compliant anti-corruption entity that no self-respecting democracy should be without. A private member's bill to remediate the legislation is a possibility, as is a favourable report to Parliament by the Constitutional Review Committee of the National Assembly. Lobbying and advocacy to achieve the goal of a STIRS-compliant anti-corruption entity are the business of all who seek a corruption-free world.